Okay.
So I was just asking when you first heard about HIV,
right,
or AIDS.
So I think I was in early in my undergraduate career. Thanks. And I heard of someone who was sick. That's what I heard. Nobody knew what these things were yet, but someone was sick. And then there was this kind of weird, inarticulate kind of brush fire of rumor that people were getting sick for no other reason than they were gay. I only knew of one at the time, but then about 6 months later, some not very much later, a man that I had been briefly lovers with when I was 18, young, he was probably in his 40s, he got sick too, and he was in the paper, and that's when I became afraid, because he would have become ill when we were together. So he was, I remember he was making frequent trips to San Francisco, and he was definitely like a bathhouse kind of guy and definitely very active. So I became kind of anxious and worried about it. And then I sublimated that. I just kind of moved on with my exams and papers and all. I was an undergraduate English student. And then I had a hemorrhage in my retina. Hold on, let me see. Oh yeah, my right retina, because I can still see it every day. And I went to a retinal specialist, and he was a kind of pasty, anxious-looking fellow who looked like he'd always failed to thrive, and he found a profession where he could be kind of mouse-like. Anyway, he put his hand on mine. It was just before Christmas. It was before my midterm exams. And he said, "Are you gay?" And the fact that he'd asked me that in the context of, without any other questions to frame that question, I'm not a stupid person, so I made the immediate connection, and my heart started racing. I became afraid. I was terrified. I left that specialist's office in a blur. I remember not knowing what to do. Like, I couldn't see out of my right eye. It had just gotten worse and worse. I went home to my mother's house. I rented a suite on the top of her house. I walked into her floor and told her that this specialist thought that I had AIDS, which was the conclusion that I drew. And back then, there was no middle step. That was it. And I spent weeks in my bedroom, holed up with the door closed, listening to CBC radio. And CBC was full of interviews of young men dying. It was just awful. It was awful. I was terrified for weeks until I got the results of my HIV test, which they actually had. It just took a long time. So I went to my physician, my GP, who had been my GP since he was 14, since I was 14. And he's the GP that was staffing the STD clinic, which was a shock to me. So there, I go in to get an anonymous test, and there's my GP administering a test. But that was okay. In the grand scheme of things, everything was okay, because the only thing I could focus on was the fact that I was dying. Anyway, my eye, no thanks to that specialist, eventually cleared up. My girlfriend at the time was leaving plates of food at my door because I wouldn't answer. It was like I became closeted just prior to that. And it was partly out of embarrassment for the gay community, which I alluded to earlier, that it was this non-functioning sort of drunken brawl of desire and incompetence. And my own residual fear about these little points of fire in terms of people dying in unexplained and very rapid ways. So I was deeply conflicted, but I was conflicted in a way that wasn't unconscious. I was very conscious of my and could articulate the conflicts I was going through at the time. That didn't change or help anything. The physical affect of experiencing that fear and loathing, you can be as articulate as you want to be, but the physical moving through that process doesn't change. It's still fear and gut-wrenching. The gut-wrenching need to be isolated. That's my answer to the question.
So then you eventually got your test results back.
Yeah, which were negative. Even then, I didn't quite believe the test, but and I attributed what would have been a positive result to the fellow who died, who had made frequent trips to San Francisco at the time. But yeah, I was negative, and I continued through school and somehow managed to pull off straight A's and the right fellowship things to go on to graduate school in London, Ontario.
And so as the 80s were, this would have been, what, 84?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
I'm just guessing from what you're saying about the test.
Yeah.
As the 80s progressed, were you getting information through any, like, was there a lot of useful information out there for you around HIV and prevention, or not so much?
I think I got most of my info. I was disconnected from the gay community during that period. When I went to London, I had, as I mentioned earlier, I'd grown up in a somewhat socially progressive circumstance. Moving to London was a culture shock because it was a much more conservative environment, and there was a gay bar there, but you had to sign in, like back in the 40s and 50s, it was members only, and nothing compared to the sort of permeability that existed in clubs in Vancouver and Victoria. So, I mean, it was definitely, like, literally closeted, literally, because there were gatekeepers, and their role was to prevent people going into those enclaves of alcohol and desire that should not have been there. Anyway, so it was a bit of a throwback for me. I remained disconnected from that whole world. I was, I think, celibate for years. Ever since that misdiagnosis, I was a kind of academic recluse, and absolutely celibate, and with a few drunken mistakes along the way that were so drunk they were basically blackout periods. And that even then, during this period, that didn't happen. It happened when I moved to Vancouver, that I kind of let loose on occasional weekends. But most of my information about HIV I gleaned through CBC Radio, through books, Randy Schiltz, Armistead Maupin, all of the sort of world stage writers and people on the world stage who were bearing witness to this, but locally, no. Locally, I regarded local gay communities with the same contempt that I had regarded them since I first came out at a very young age.
So, you talked about, you know, not having much of a sex life for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Was that like a conscious decision? Was that like made in light of, you know, the risks that were out there? Was that like more of an effective thing where it was like your body shutting down due to the fear?
It was both. It was both. And I don't even need the benefit of hindsight to be able to attribute sort of quashed desire out of fear, out of varying goalposts about what was safe and what wasn't back then, because the goalposts kept changing. And from what I could tell, the only safe stance was abstinence. Certainly early on, And remember, there was a lot of, there was fear within the gay community during that period, but profound fear in the general society. So it was really hard to take a middle road during that period. Anyway, and the other thing was, I just didn't feel any desire.
Do you remember what was being said in some of the mainstream kind of perspectives on the epidemic in those early years?
Yeah, certainly. Shame and fear. Fear was most of it. In terms of mainstream responses, I can never forget the short pieces on CBC Radio where young men were being ostracized not just by their families but by whole communities, insisting that they move out. Young children who were diagnosed for whatever reason being asked to leave their schools. I mean, there was, with the exception of people in public office and sophisticated bureaucrats, policymakers, the general public was reacting with the need to ostracize. Generally speaking, that was their response, which is very tribal. It's a very instinctive tribal kind of response. And I was aware at the time that the goal of people in creating policy was to buffer those base instincts in order to protect the greater good and the individuals who were vulnerable within the greater good, if that makes sense.
So I guess that would have kind of manifested as like this increase in, was it like a spike in homophobia at the time, or does it coincide with this in any way, shape, or form?
I'm not so sure. Well, I mean, there was... around that time, maybe a little later, I don't know when Angels in America came out, but there was the guy who started ACT UP, that brilliant fellow from New York.
Larry Kramer,
yeah. He wrote a book called Faggots that came out, I think, in the mid-80s, I think. It was around there. I'd have to, you know, I don't know what the date is. Larry Kramer, again, I was an academic. I was reading for information more than I was getting it from the public or from the gay community, certainly. So Kramer's book was very critical and harsh about the gay community. It was a very critical look at the gay community. And I remember thinking, applauding Kramer for having the courage to take a stance against the political correctness of the most liberal ends of the gay community who were fighting back against institutional steps to protect people. The gay community, some at the time, were saying, this is absurd, this is a conspiracy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, really, it was there. They're just trying to stop us from having sex. I mean, really, it's in the literature, it's there. And that kind of ignorance was what Kramer was pushing back against, and I was a big fan of Mr. Kramer.
Was HIV showing up in your, like, personal life at all during this period?
I didn't notice it. Again, I was detached. I was just studying. Once I moved from London, Ontario, I moved to this Killam Fellowship at UBC to do my PhD in English. I arrived there, and it's then that I felt safe, finally. I felt safe for a whole number of reasons. I had a good friend, a fellow academic, who was living with me, a woman. We were friends, still are. We lived in a spectacular waterfront Kits penthouse, looking over Kit's pool. My mother furnished it over the summer while we were traveling, and we arrived and the whole thing was furnished with Persian carpets and silver and everything. It was like moving into an architectural digest. And it was just a chain of events, the fellowship, this beautiful home that was affordable, and vast and spectacular. My schooling, which was rewarding, I felt safe. And out of that safety, for the first time, I began to... I became like ultra fit. So I was biking up to UBC. I had a part-time job in Metrotown, so I was biking from... I was hyper-healthy. And that made me feel safe too, is that sense of vigor and health. I think that unconsciously was my pushing back against this this environment of illness, because I knew it was there. I was surrounded by it, even though I had no one that I could identify with who was still alive, who was living with HIV. I knew it was all around me. I was pushing back in ways that I could, and then I started to loosen up in Vancouver, and I started dating. And I was young and attractive and fit and all those things, and was very successful at that project of dating, and had a lot of fun for the first time ever. Instead of it being fearful, and it was fearful even as a kid, before HIV it was fearful, because these older men, I didn't know them, and their world of alcohol and dark bars was like, what the fuck is this? Like, why are people living like this? It was always alien to me. Anyway, at UBC in Vancouver, I started to branch out. And then in the midst of all that, old friends of mine who I had gone to art school with, who were either fellow students or I became aware that they were ill. Out of that sense of vigor and health that I had, I felt a commitment finally to give back, that I needed to do something. And so I volunteered. I had time as a grad student. I volunteered at AIDS Vancouver with the helpline first and the speakers bureau next, going to schools and so on. I thrived in that environment. I found it really rewarding. And during that same period, which would have been later 80s, old friends and dear friends of mine, they started getting sick, because people's progression through HIV, the early onset ones were the ones that started the fires first. People were aware of those deaths early on in the trajectory of the disease. Those who progressed more slowly, like 10 years or whatever it might be, those are the ones that started getting sick in the late 80s. Without any medication, they were fine until a certain point. You must know the all of those details in the background, but a lot of those people were my friends. So my exposure to friends and acquaintances who I loved with HIV came hand in hand with my parallel involvement with AIDS Vancouver. They weren't linked. They kind of happened in step with each other, if that makes sense.
So you find yourself kind of involved with this ASO,
yeah,
but you were also kind of involved informally in supporting your friends.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Just being there for your friends.
What's interesting is that one dear friend who I looked after on a regular basis right until he gave up and died, he was an old art school friend of mine when we were in art school in Nelson together. Lovely, beautiful man. And he was my age. He had no relationship to the AIDS community at all. There was, it's a kind of flip of the coin to when I was a kid with the women's movement, and gay men had, aside from being drunk, had nothing to do with building anything. And then we had this AIDS movement, and then I had these gay men who I'd known for many years who I didn't really actually know as gay. I didn't know they were gay until much later. I've never had good gaydar, ever, like zero. My staff at work tease me about it constantly, because I have 50, 55 employees, and they all know I'm gay, but and we have some gay employees too, but I have the worst gaydar in the entire fleet. Women I can spot immediately. Lesbians is like, I got them. But gay men, not a chance. Anyway, these guys weren't affiliated with the AIDS movement at all. They had no interest in it. They were hospitalized and sent home and hospitalized and, you know, prophylaxis for whatever they needed at the time, whatever the technology was at the time. Their interface was through the hospital and not through the gay community at all. So it was kind of like a split existence at the same time, because I was becoming politicized. For the first time, gay men were actually building and organizing things. For the first time in my experience. And it always irritated me, pissed me off, that it took a kind of mass suicide to motivate gay men. Whereas on women's side of things, it just took a sense of social justice. And it still pisses me off to this very day that men needed a bigger push to jump off that cliff of inertia and indifference than it took women. Women, in my experience, you could look tribally at the fact that they want to build relationships and community, but I expect better of men in general.
Were women jumping on board with the AIDS?
Absolutely, absolutely. There were two different kinds of women that I remember at AIDS Vancouver. There were the political zealots and deeply motivated, intelligent people. Some were too passionate, some were clever. And then there were the what I call the BMW ladies, who would arrive at Park. I don't know if you remember Park, but AV, PWA, Positive Women's Network, all joined together. I was involved with it at the time when we were on Helmiken, and we actually before Helmiken, so we moved to Helmiken as the shared resource, and all kinds of BMW ladies, which were affluent women who could have been contributing or volunteering for the art gallery. Made no difference to them, but and they would be walking up in their Chanel suits, I exaggerate, up to the upstairs of Park, and these itchy, skittish, emaciated men would be running up and down the stairs saying, "Oh my God, I've got anal herpes," and all this kind of stuff. It was a deep contrast, but there was the kind of stalwart left-wing women that were the kind of women that I grew up with, who were involved with the AIDS movement in lockstep with the few male leaders in the field at the time. And then there were the social do-gooders who drove luxury cars and lived in North Van.
We haven't heard as much about those people. We've heard a lot about lesbians.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure.
Stepping up. And people who had feminist backgrounds.
Yeah, people, definitely. So. Yeah.
But BMW ladies, those are new.
Oh, they were there. Absolutely. Yeah. I recognized them because I grew up with BMW ladies. So my mother's family were full of BMW ladies. My mother drove a Volkswagen station wagon, and she was definitely the oddball. But that milieu of women were definitely involved in the AIDS movement. No question about it.
So what was AIDS Vancouver doing at the time while you were volunteering there?
Back then it was really dealing with fear. On the part of the public, it was dealing with fear. So fear on the one hand, and then care and advocacy on the part of patients to get drugs that were still in pipelines, to challenge doctors and institutions for prophylaxis, which back then was really the only preventive treatment that there was. So they were doing that. They were doing the sort of academic institutional approach to advocate on behalf of people who were sick. And then on the public end, it was dealing with fear and trying to educate and be clear about prevention strategies to people who are afraid. And so the teaching methods and the amount of information you can get across to people who are terrified is a challenge, and that's what AV and other ASOs around North America, that was their biggest challenge, was to figure out how to communicate the principles of prevention to people who are so afraid they're not listening. So that's what it was like in the early days. Yeah.
And that message was kind of coalescing around this idea of safe sex?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was, yeah. Safer sex, yeah.
Safer
yeah,
sex.
Yeah.
And so then at the, you said simultaneously you're kind of getting involved on a more personal level with your friends.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think, what was it about, ASOs that maybe your friends didn't connect with? I'm just curious if you have any ideas about that.
I thought about that at the time. These were men who were self-sufficient. They weren't political. They weren't interested in politics. And what was inevitable in the development of ASOs back then was it was a fight to the death. Like it was, the stakes were very high, and people were of all stripes and all backgrounds were afraid, including the people who were building ASOs. Everyone was afraid or angry. And the ones that, as the evolution of ASOs came out of anger and a profound sense of social justice and the need to just rescue people. And so it was highly political by virtue of the environment in which they sprung up, because nobody could be indifferent. It was not a medical clinic or a travel agency. It was highly political. The very fact that it existed was political. And so there were lots of gay men in my experience, lots meaning the few that I knew and their friends and so on, who had no interest in being political. They just wanted to live. And as the disease progressed, they wanted to live on their own terms, and they didn't want to be political objects.
What was it like being in a caregiving role for those people?
Sort of hopeless. In the early days, it was hopeless because, immunosuppression, even now, is a big challenge, right? But back then, I mean, we have AIDS to thank for all kinds of advancements in terms of dealing with people who are immunosuppressed. A lot of my friends and friends of friends all over the world died, and the learning curve that the medical profession underwent, in all sincerity, but it improved because of this great big petri dish, this great big population of trial runs around how to deal with immunosuppression. So it was kind of hopeless. There was really nothing to do. I think there was AZT and DDI and a few things early on that people were taking them. There were side effects and all kinds of things. Some people couldn't take them at all. And even if you could take them, it's like, well, is it doing anything? Nobody knew. People were trying anything. Barry, my dearest friend, and he's the one that I cared for daily. And I remember he was in the hospital most of the time over the last, maybe last, he was in the hospital a lot. At St. Paul's, which is where I was born. So I remember the poetic sense that, I kept visiting this hospital all the time. I was born there. But he knew he was dying, and eventually he stopped the fight. Like, he got sick. He and other people got sick of all the medication. Kind of like cancer therapies, eventually some cancer patients just say, I've had enough, this is enough. And Barry reached that stage, and I remember being shocked that he was 28 and aging before my eyes, not physically, although he was emaciated at that point, but he was aging psychologically. He had become someone in his 80s from the perspective of his soul. He was worn out. And to be worn out at 28, I remember observing that, and really struck home. That kind of evolution can speed up, and you can basically go through your life within the space of a few years and reach the sense of closure within 12 to 24 months. Because he wasn't caught off guard. He knew, he was prepared. Mm-hmm. And at parallel to this, I was, you know, being political and at AIDS Vancouver. And then I would go to St. Paul's, and politics had nothing to do with it. It was just intimate, daily care in with a sense of resignation and hopelessness.
That sounds political in its own way.
Yeah.
Just, you know, yeah. Valuing your friend's lives.
Oh, totally. And, totally. Yeah.
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 And I mean, you're talking about how this was kind of a petri dish for the leaps and bounds that the medical system took during this time in terms of how they treat immune deficiency.
Well, it's astonishing. It's astonishing how quickly medical professionals and researchers around the world mobilized. Who cares why? I think it's well intended on most parts, but certainly. Pharmaceuticals and all kinds of enterprises and institutions mobilized to get this done, and they were cooperative in many instances. And that too was unprecedented. Rather than cloistering themselves as institutions, they were working together in order to speed up the learning curve. I was aware of that back then, and I was impressed by it back then, and I don't know how it happened, or if it's happened since. I don't know, I'm out of touch now.
Were you aware of some of the AIDS activism that was going on in Vancouver?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I was involved. Yeah, I was. I was. I was hired on at AIDS Vancouver. I became a full-time staff person. I quit grad school and started working full-time at AV and PARC by extension. I was one of the founding board directors of PARC. When I was 30 or something, I remember signing the document, the charter document or whatever it was, but not through intent. It's just I happened to be in the room. But I'm proud of that. But I'm proud of the day-to-day work that went on in places like that, because without it, without the persistence of ASOs, as clumsy as they were, because they were community-based organizations. So the skill sets that are brought to bear on those places are hit and miss, right? Like, they're not professional. But that, to some extent, is their advantage, because they don't know how to be polite. And so they were abrasive and abrupt and loud and noisy. And I think they actually did achieve, they achieved good things as a result. So I was definitely involved. I was the assistant to the director of education, full-time on salary through Rick Marchand. And then when he moved into the position of executive director, I followed him and I became the assistant to the executive director. And then I was hired over to Victoria, AIDS Vancouver Island, and I became the communications and fund development coordinator, and brought the AIDS Walk to Victoria, which was highly political back then too, and it was a very public position. So I was in the media a lot, and I was, you know, fairly polished and professional about it. So I was useful to the media because they could count on good sound bites, not as long as these ones. But and I remember Princess Diana died right around whenever it was. I don't know. I have no memory of when it was anymore. She was a big deal. She was touching people with HIV, and that was back during periods of fear when the idea was verboten. And I remember giving good sound bites about Princess Diana, and I remember thinking, you know, how do I talk about this woman who I don't know with some taste and sensitivity to the fact that, you know, the media are hungry for content, and I needed to say something that was useful to AVI, useful to the AIDS community, and respectful of this woman who had just died. And I think I came up with something that I, in advance, because I was prepared for it, I thought, God, I'm going to have to comment. I was prepared, and I said something to the effect that Princess Diana demonstrated leadership during a time when statesmen around the world were not, which I thought was, you know, I felt okay about doing that because it was sensational, right? Which made me uncomfortable. I don't want to fuel other people's fires. Anyway, so in my role over at AIDS Vancouver Island, it was very public, and Victoria was a little bit behind Vancouver in terms of social acceptance of AIDS, which by direct link meant gay men, which made people uncomfortable, and I was a public figure during that time.
And by extension, probably. You kind of were out as well.
Oh, yeah, right? Absolutely. Yeah. I was in Vancouver. I met my real only lover when I was 30. I had just turned 30. And he and I, we went to the Pacific Center Mall to a jeweler's. This is back in 91 to buy wedding rings. And the jeweler in the Pacific Center Mall was horrified. This woman was, she blanched with disgust, I remember. I felt no, because of my upbringing, my willingness to apologize for who I was zero, like zero. I wasn't shy or withholding about who I was. Internally I was sometimes, but externally not a chance. So, we got these rings, despite the objections of the retailer, and exchanged rings in the law courts on Howe Street. There's a little Japanese garden sort of in one corner. And a security guard came up and thought we were doing a drug deal or something. So, but we were together for 19 years. And it really, ultimately, it's the only relationship I ever had, aside from forays into the mess of anonymous gay life. But we moved to Victoria together, and we were a very out couple, and we were an out couple in Vancouver as well.
How long were you at ABI for?
Probably 5 years, 4 years, 4 years. So right up until maybe 2000, something like that, 2001. Yeah.
And why was the AIDS walk considered so political at the time? Just because of that connection with gayness?
Oh, yeah. Back when it was first introduced, yeah. And hey, Scott. Hi. But it was very public, and but what really was exciting about that project was the big sort of media celebrities in Victoria, for what they were, latched onto this project, and we did incredible work. We had TV spots and fairly sophisticated promotional ads that were in print, TV, radio. Like we really were slick, and the AIDS Walk in Victoria was really successful. It was really awesome, and it mobilized people. And it was around that period, the whole AIDS Walk concept in Vancouver and then Victoria was a chance for people to feel like they were doing something positive rather than just living in despair and with a sense of resignation that it was hopeless. The AIDS Walk in its first years was a chance for people to say, oh my God, there is hope just by virtue of us being here together. And that was a cultural shift that is important to recognize, because before then, that would never have been possible. And I don't know what triggered it, that sense of, I mean, back then, if you went to the Castro, you would have seen the same thing, this kind of despair, and in San Francisco, this ghost town kind of quality that wasn't just in San Francisco, it was pervasive, further exacerbated that kind of vestigial shame that was of that generation. That, sure, they were all liberated and all this kind of stuff, but that it was grounded in shame. I don't know if it is anymore. I hope it isn't, but back then it was. And the AIDS Walk was a kind of rite of passage and a kind of like It was kind of like a wedding ceremony where everyone's celebrating the achievement of community, which is what a wedding is. Anyway, that was a kind of moral victory, the fact that those events were successful for as many years as they were.
And my impression is that another kind of big impact was that it was one of these kind of moments where mainstream society got on board.
Yeah, absolutely.
Public
yeah.
and obvious
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just gay men that were...
Totally.
A part of that.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about Park, too. Park, how long was Park like a thing for? Because it didn't stay that way for all that long.
I left before Park... evolved past its parkness.
Yes.
So I think that BCPWA, AV, and PWN were trying to share resources and reduce costs, and it made good sense. And the fact that the whole idea back then, I was involved in creating its first annual report, and I remember we hired this slick. Communications company to do some of the work, but I was tasked with the writing and working with a photographer, basic project managing it. And the messaging behind all of it was one-stop shopping, because people affected, I mean, there's mobility issues, there's poverty, there's all kinds of things that people who were living with HIV were facing. And so if we had one location that had a food bank that didn't just serve gay men but served women and people who were street involved, whatever it was, street involvement was a tiny sliver of the work back then, but drug use, that kind of thing. So the whole idea was a good one. It was a good idea. But politics... in particular, the identity politics took over, and identity politics between people who are drug involved, gay men, the BMW women who weren't interested in the drug involved people. They wanted to rescue gay men. The affluent people wanted to rescue the bright lights. The bright lights were the fashion designers, the hairdressers, the people who amused and entertain the people who wanted to do the rescuing. Once the influx of drug use from the downtown east side and so on started presenting with HIV and then HCV, which was kind of a separate learning curve, and then all of the associated problems like herpes and all of these things that nobody, it was like, whoa, what is going on? We don't know how to deal with this stuff. The identity politics at that point started to rip Park apart really early on in its evolution. Like, it didn't have much of a chance to get going. I was gone at that point. I was over in Victoria.
Yeah, because I mean, initially these ASOs were essentially gay men's
yes,
organizations.
Absolutely.
And now yeah. you have this new population coming in that has very different needs.
Totally, yeah.
I imagine it caused all sorts of tension.
And practical differences too, like a lot of gay men at the time were well mannered and polite, and I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but white middle class men. They were raised that way. They knew how to behave in ways that were predictable and acceptable to the institutions that grew up around to support them. And then when new people came in with different life skills and backgrounds that had nothing to do with what these service providers were used to, it was a real challenge. And in my case, I know that I was very clear when I moved to Victoria that I had very little interest in dealing with that population. I didn't know them. They weren't my people. I'd do my work, but it wasn't the reason I was there. And I didn't apologize for that at the time, and I still don't. Certainly ASOs have evolved to meet that need, but it wasn't my need. And that's okay.
One of the other things that I had the impression that might have been happening during this time at ASOs was like kind of this professionalization.
Uh-huh.
Like were you kind of witness to like that shift from like being very, I mean, they were still volunteer driven organizations, but you know, like bringing on more staff members?
Oh yeah, and, yeah. Yeah, like AV, for example, grew from an executive director with, back when we were on this, we were in this little sort of back alley somewhere. I don't even remember. It was a small little office. There was an executive director, and I think a part-time volunteer coordinator, and that was it. Everyone else was volunteer. When we moved into the park building, we expanded rapidly. So there were directors of everything. We wound up from two staff, I think, when I first got involved, to 20, 25, 30 staff by the time I left, which is rapid growth over a period of a few years, yeah. Mostly grad students, you know, like yourself.
Like you at the time, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. And yeah, they were reasonably well-paying careers, and when I moved to AIDS Vancouver, actually, this speaks to the professionalization. When I moved there, I was hired on contract without having been told by the executive director and board who hired me that they were in the process of unionizing. And so I landed in this place, and then boom, I was part of a union without my foreknowledge. And I wasn't a particular fan of that process in nonprofits, and as someone who's the GM of a nonprofit now I'm still not a fan of unions and nonprofits, but
And when you moved back to Victoria, was there still that kind of personal involvement at the same time, or was it more professional only at that point, or institutional or organizational?
No, it was still personal. I still had friends who were affected. The care and treatment of people who were affected was becoming more sophisticated at that point. The prognoses were better, for the most part. Again, there was still intolerance, and there were strange side effects like lipodystrophy and all those other things. People were disfigured, emaciated in those classic ways where people with HIV were immediately recognizable to certainly people who knew. It was like a tattoo. You couldn't get away from it. People were going in for cosmetic surgery to deal with it. I was dealing mostly with friends and colleagues who had HIV and were living with it as colleagues, as professional colleagues, with whom I worked on a daily basis. So including at the federal level, provincial, and at the local level. So I would say a good significant portion of the people who I was working with had HIV. 20, if you had to put a number on it, maybe 20%.
What was it like being at an ASO, working with an ASO as that shift occurred, as treatments kind of started to actually emerge that were not without side effects, but were actually effective in some respects?
It was exciting. It was nice. Nice, that's such a bad word. It was inspiring. It was exhilarating to feel like the medical community was starting to get traction. But that exhilaration, or that hope, that optimism, was happening at the sort of bird's eye level. Certainly, in my case anyway, because I was in the industry, if you want to call it that, from a bird's eye perspective, progress was being made. At the local perspective, the level of the individual, it was still so hit and miss that you had to make a kind of disconnect between your optimism and the direct lived experience of the person in front of you, which had very little to do with the sense of excitement. So it was an odd kind of double vision that was going on at that during that period.
When did that optimism start to feel like it was to some extent being fulfilled?
Well, that was heart, highly active retroviral therapy, whatever it's called. Once the heart stuff kicked in, then it was like, okay, now the bird's eye view and the local experience of an individual are starting to meet up, and we can get excited for individuals now. Prior to that, you had to be, it was like pregnancy. You don't want to jinx it. you don't want to say to somebody, "Oh my God, I'm so glad you're pregnant," because you don't. You know, it was like what if it's not successful? You had to be really careful and tactful about it. Once the heart stuff started getting traction and there was this sense like, "Oh my God, it's working," then you could extend the optimism that you saw in the big picture to the person in front of you, and that was awesome.
That must have been amazing.
It was, yeah.
It sounds like, in some respects, the epidemic maybe changed your relationships in the community.
It did. I went through a period. My response to the first inklings of the disease amplified my original impression of the gay community as dysfunctional and addicted to behaviors that weren't productive, modeling the outcomes predicted by Larry Kramer, and that was writ large for me all over the place, and I shut down. Later on, I felt a sense, quite honestly, of survivor guilt. Through graduate school, as I realized I was living in Vancouver, which was early on and deeply affected by HIV, I felt a need to contribute because I had survived. Remember, I was misdiagnosed very young. This incompetent professional made the wrong suggestions. And that affected me for much of my early adult life. Once I got involved in HIV, I kind of got to see men and women operating at a level that reminded me of my childhood exposure to the women's community. And that was exciting and gratifying to see. And I felt good about being a part of it. And then later, that moment in time where this mobilization around social justice, around gender, sexuality, the terror of illness and the unknown, once that moved into much more complex social issues of poverty, substance use, all of these other really complex things, I moved away once again a little bit, out of choice at that point.
I mean, it does sound like quite a stark juxtaposition, that first glimpse of the gay community is very hedonistic.
Yeah.
And then this glimpse of the gay community, AIDS service organizations, very caring, human.
Yep.
And see why that would have led to a shift in your relationship to the community.
Uh-huh, yeah. But at least I got a number of years of feeling really proud of the accomplishments of my comrades and fellow gay men under incredible duress. It was a kind of war. And gay men have never had it easy. Sailing through life, at least white middle class Canadian life, sailing through life through a kind of prescribed set of doors. You go from youth to adulthood, you go to college, like all of these things that just kind of happen without the need to painstakingly observe your own position within it, is something that gay men have to do anyway, because they view themselves as actors and as objects by virtue of their position in society. So the idea that they also had to fight society at large, not just at the level of their own lack of privacy, because as a gay man, being out as a gay man back then, I don't know about now, but it was an act of courage, because people speculated about your private life and you were up for public consumption, which is something that straight people rarely ever experience, except for women maybe, because they see themselves as objects too. But I got to be proud of my role and more importantly, the role of my comrades in standing up and fighting for something that they believed in. And that's a privilege that people who've gone to war, certainly they're deeply moved by that sense of camaraderie that they shared with their peers as well. So I'm grateful for that.
And it was like going through a war in a lot of ways, from what we've heard from a lot of other folks. So it's an apt analogy.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I haven't asked about at all is just around how the government was responding. Did you have any thoughts on how that was playing out at the time?
Well, I mean, I was aware of what... I mean, certainly in my role, I was highly aware of what... I was the one preparing the grants for AV on behalf of my... directors, just because I was a good writer, so I ended up compiling the grants and so on and writing them in some cases. The federal government was highly responsive, and they were funding AIDS in a way that was it was excellent, because they didn't have to. Policy is blind to, or was back then, policy was blind to the vagaries of public opinion, which is the way it should be. So back then it was functioning in that way. Provincially it was much more politically volatile, up and down and up and down, depending on whether it was SOCRED or whatever it was called, Liberal, or they changed their names, the right wing all the time. The left wing was pretty consistent. But it depended on who was in government. But generally speaking, ASOs had money and we raised a lot of money too for direct care, but governments were certainly on board. I didn't get a sense that they were the enemy. The enemy was your neighbors, not the people at the tables of government.
How do you think the epidemic changed the gay community, besides what we've already kind of talked about?
Well, it depends on what period of time you're looking at. Because it's the gay community's vacillated. Again, if you talk about the devolution of PARC, the gay community mobilized in the early years of HIV and then was compromised by all kinds of identity politics. As our response to HIV became complicated by who was living with it. So that, I mean, that's all I can say. It was just there's not much left of it from my perspective. But then I'm not exposed to that world anymore. I've drifted away. I'm too busy doing other things.
How has your perspective on HIV changed, looking toward the present, I guess?
Well, it's a terrible tragedy that happened, but it's a terrible tragedy in league and in competition with all kinds of other tragedies in retrospect. It was distinguished by the fact that it was embedded in stigma right from the get-go. So that's the big difference. Like, people are dying of starvation, and they're compromised by virtue of where they grew up. There's all kinds of things going on in the world. But HIV was unique in that it challenged governments, societies, neighborhoods in ways that nothing else had, in my experience, except for maybe the McCarthy era in the US or something, the Vietnam War, for example. But It forced people to take a stand, regardless of where you stood. You weren't just going to sit down. You stood up and paid attention. I've lost track. What was the question?
Oh, just around how your perspective on HIV has changed.
Okay. I mean, now it's kind of... I think I wrote this somewhere to a friend of mine recently, that HIV... if it were a door on a street, you're walking down a street, and there are all these doors for different things, HIV now has to compete with every other door in town, It's got a glass front with an aluminum bar, just like every other door, and that's just the way it is. So the whole approach to it and the experience of it is has become part of the realm of the everyday. And maybe that's okay. Certainly, the introduction of HIV into our world caused all kinds of benefits, rapid advancements in medicine and research, not just clinical research and pharmaceutical research, but qualitative research. There's all kinds of things that benefits that have spun off that maybe all the people who died terrified at the beginning of the disease, if there's any poetic justice in any of that, it's that they contributed those terrified deaths. Those are the ones that bother me the most. The fact that that first wave of HIV died in abject terror and a lot of times in isolation. That's what mobilized me as a young man who survived, and I still look back on that. And I'm glad that the world has benefited because of that. We'll see the next time something similar happens again, whether we behave any differently.
Yeah. One would hope.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I think I've covered most of what I wanted to ask you. We always like to ask near the end, just because we are kind of trying to think a little bit intergenerationally, about whether you have any lessons you'd like to share with folks, maybe younger guys, younger gay men today, who didn't live through this, who didn't witness this in any way, shape, or form. Messages or wisdom you'd like to impart?
I guess I'm turning 57 the day after tomorrow. I'm not a real birthday person, but it's a milestone of some kind. And I manage a hardworking, dynamic group of about 50 to 60 employees. Most of them are between the ages of 16 and 22. In my world, they're athletes for the most part. So they're on-water athletes. They're a mix of straight, for the most part, gay. HIV isn't something that is part of their world or vocabulary. I don't think it occurs to any of them. It might. It doesn't come up in discussion. But what does come up on a regular basis is a sense of community and fair play and a general sense of optimism and acceptance that goes on between all of these young people that I work with, that doesn't seem to stigmatize people beyond a sense of humor, whether you're gay or straight or, I mean, we don't have any transgendered staff that I know of. I don't think I do. But things have moved forward. And I think that for gay men in particular, I'm reminded of the Jews who honor the people they've lost to the Second World War and the steps subsequent to the Second World War, and the actual people who fought in the Second World War to give us the life that we have today. We owe, including me, we owe all those people a sense of duty. And, God, I'm getting emotional. It's good to honor those people. Anyway, this doesn't come up with all of the young people that I deal with, but the very fact that I'm a gay man publicly looking after all of these exuberant young people is a signal of progress that it's not about me, it's about the fact that people demonstrated courage And it wasn't an easy thing for them to do. God, I have vivid memories of the fear. I can't get over it. Anyway, that's what I would say. I can't believe I'm emotional. It's okay. Okay, I'm better now.
Okay. But to remember, I mean, that's really what it comes down to in a lot of ways, to acknowledge and remember.
Yeah, and for young people who are dealing with isolation, because I don't delude myself. I think that being gay and young is still isolating. You may have apps and, you know, Pornhub or whatever it is that people are using these days that give you a sense of community. I feel like I'm returning back to when I was a teenager going to these bars. It's like, so Pornhub is today's gay bar, essentially. And like, you know, I would urge young people to look beyond the gay community for role models and be their own role model and integrate with the community at large and just be proud of who you are. You don't need to be stitched together with a community just by virtue of your sexual choice, which is a victory. And that is the one significant victory out of all of this, that you can be a leader or look to leaders, not just because of who you sleep with. Nevertheless, if you are isolated, if these young folks are isolated, you know, take steps to stop that from happening to yourself.
Find a community, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, whatever that looks like, yeah.
Well, that's kind of it for my formal questions. We always like to just leave some time at the end just to ask if you had anything you wanted to add or anything that we covered in passing that you wanted to expand upon.
Nope. Yeah. Yeah. It was good.
Thank you, Eric.
I surprised myself. Anyway, you can turn it off.
Yeah, I'll stop this if you have had your say.
Yep.
Well, you